Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The finish line really is in sight. That's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. But Republican Senator Orrin Hatch had a different view. It's going to be a holy war. Both were talking about the 2,000 or so page Senate health reform bill. Democratic leaders now want senators to vote to move it to a debate. They need 60 votes to do that. Rick Klein is senior political correspondent for ABC News and author of the network's blog, The Note. And Rick, when the action was in the Senate Finance Committee, all eyes were on Maine Republican Olympia Snowe. This round, there's some arm twisting of moderate Democratic senators. Who are they? And since this is just a vote to take the bill to debate, will those senators really hold out?
There are three that are, in addition to Joe Lieberman, I should put him in a separate category, because he has said he's going to allow it to go forward, but he has other concerns. But the three are Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas. And in all three of the cases, they have left some ambiguity about it, but most observers really do believe that they will support the procedural motion this week. That just allows the Senate to begin the debate. That, though, is going to be a lot different than the standard to approve the final bill, and the Democrats are going to need 60 votes twice on this.
Well, and one of the concerns, and we'll hear about it in the run-up to the vote, it's not clear, you say, what's being produced and how much it'll cost. But Harry Reid says his bill would raise Medicare payroll taxes for people making over $250,000. He's suggesting a new tax on elective cosmetic surgery. It's being called the Beau tax. Taxes on high-end insurance policies. And the Congressional Budget Office came out with an official number yesterday predicting the Senate bill would cut the deficit in the long run. So what is the argument going to be about cost?
They needed that kind of an estimate from the Congressional Budget Office to be even able to have the debate any further. But a lot of folks are skeptical of that. One big hole in their estimate is that, according to Harry Reid's plan, there would be major, major cuts in Medicare if costs continue to rise above inflation. Nobody thinks that there's political will to do that, so they put off some of the tough decisions. Another thing that they do is sort of an accounting maneuver. They start the new taxes in 2010, but the benefits wouldn't start until 2014, so they're collecting additional revenue to pay for how expensive it's going to be. Obviously, in the long term, that's not sustainable. You won't be able to take 4 years, 5 years off from providing health care to build up money.
So those are some of the questions. Let's talk about what the bill would do. It would require almost everyone to have insurance, penalize some employers who fail to provide insurance, prohibit insurers from discriminating against people because of pre-existing conditions. But then we come to abortion and the public option. So what is the public option offer in the Senate bill?
It does create a public option, but it gives states the ability to opt out. There's a lot of question as to how a state would do that, whether there would be many legislatures and governors that go along with it. But that's a critical component for particularly some red state Democrats to have the chance to get out. It is not a trigger option the way that Olympia Snowe, the senator from Maine, wanted it. There would be a national public option, but not every state would have to participate in it.
Yeah, it'd be voluntary. Well, and the bill is also less restrictive, perhaps a gift to Democrats, than the House bill is on abortion. It would allow abortions to be paid for out of personal premiums, not taxpayer subsidies for people who have subsidized insurance.
That's a significant difference. The difference really is between maintaining the status quo, as the Senate bill tries to do, where taxpayer dollars cannot now by law go toward funding abortions, and going a little bit further, which is what the House passed bill would do, and to expand not just the public option from prohibiting abortion coverage, but also any insurance plan that takes part in the National Insurance Exchange, which would be most plans. So that would result, presumably, in people losing current coverage, and that's a restriction that people that support abortion rights are really not comfortable with.
Well, so we're going to hear about all of these things over the next couple of days. But, Rick, one last question. How much will this week's explosive debate over new government task force guidelines on mammograms affect this vote on health care reform? The guidelines are just guidelines. They're not law. But listening to talk radio, for instance, people are already confusing them with the health reform debate.
Right. This has nothing to do with that, but it does have a big impact, I think. And we're hearing a number of Republicans saying, look, when we were worried about death panels and bureaucrats making decisions, this is the kind of thing we were talking about. And certainly the reports of people thinking that these are new government mandates and the fact that government agencies could end up following these recommendations has given a lot of people pause. You see the Obama administration come out yesterday and say, look, basically ignore what these new recommendations are, what you're doing before, keep on doing them. They realize the political peril this puts them in.
That's Rick Klein, senior political correspondent for ABC News, author of the network's blog, The Note. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Remember actress Hilary Swank in the 2007 film Freedom Riders? Her character was based on real-life teacher Erin Gruwell, who reached out to her students in Long Beach, California, by getting them to do exercises in order to write about their experiences in journals.
Listen to me, all of you.
Stand on the line if you've lost a friend to gang violence. Stay on the line if you've lost more than one friend. Three. Four or more. From this moment on, the person you were, that person's turn is over.
Everyone has their own story. We're going to write in these journals.
In real life, Erin Gruwell helped her students publish those journals in the best-selling book, The Freedom Writer's Diary. Now Erin Gruwell is out with a new book from the perspective of teachers. It's called Teaching Hope, and it draws on the experiences of 150 educators who all went to Erin and her former students for training at the Freedom Writers Foundation. And Erin Gruwell joins us from the studios of NPR West in California. Erin, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And that scene that we heard where Hilary Swank put a line in the middle of the room and told students to come stand on it, you really did that, didn't you?
I did, and I continue to do that with both teachers and students alike.
You know, some might say, is it also, you know, overly dramatic? I mean, are you asking kids to maybe feel that they have to compare to their other friends and have something terrible have happened to them? You know, it's sort of a fine line as to when this violence in their lives gets over-dramatized and even romanticized and when it's going to open them up to talk about it. Did you ever worry about that?
In my particular case, I began teaching after the Los Angeles riots, and so tragically, 126 murders happened in their community. So students were used to being pallbearers. Students were used to standing in assembly lines at funeral parlors. And students were used to burying their friends and family. And so in that particular case, that was a question that united my students.
And they're not romanticizing it. They're living it.
They're living it. And I think for so many of them, to have the opportunity to strip away that facade that they'd put on, they had such a tough exterior. And at that moment, they became very empathic and compassionate towards one another.
Well, and what did it do for you? Because here you were, a white teacher in this area of Long Beach that's largely minority. What was your disconnect and what was your connection in that moment?
It was startling. I was a suburbanite. I came from Newport Beach. I was wearing polka dots and pearls. And I think when my students looked at me, they thought, who is this crazy white woman with her white polka dots, her white pearls, and her white privilege? And how is she going to relate to us? And at that moment, it bonded all of us together because I realized that they too had a story. If I was going to use Shakespeare or Homer or any great story of the past, I had to include their stories as well.
Well, as we said, it can be a cliche, you know, a white teacher from privileged background, startled by reality of inner city kids. But it's real. And you found other teachers wrestling with it, you know, if not maybe post-riot gang violence. What were some other teachers wrestling with?
I think teachers are trying to make a connection in this age where we unfortunately teach to a test. A lot of teachers have lost their passion. And in this age of unfunded mandates, most teachers will say that Leave No Child Behind has not worked. And we're grappling to keep the nobility and the passion in our profession. So the very first story is teacher walking in and all of that giddiness and anticipation about being a teacher. And 30 seconds into the job, he realizes, oh, my God, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah, this is the teacher who had index cards for every student, and he had the question, what makes you unique? And he realized that there were, like, street crickets playing in the classroom. And he talks to one student in particular who has a hard time saying what's unique about him because he seems to be an illegal immigrant.
And this story I thought was very provocative, and I chose this story deliberately to open the book. Because it's a story about identity. It's a middle school kid who is living in mid-America in a predominantly Caucasian community. And it turns out that his parents were from Mexico. And he's trying to give this kid the opportunity to be proud of his culture and proud of his roots. And I love the fact that this teacher doesn't give up.
And what he ends up writing on the card, you know, what's unique about me? I was born. You know,
yes.
And I'm here. What are some of the other specific situations that you found teachers coming across?
There's teachers who are grappling with kids who try to commit suicide using a pencil in their classroom. Teachers who stand at a pulpit at a funeral parlor and have to bury a student. Teachers who deal with students who can't do their homework. because they're homeless and don't have electricity or a place to even rest their head that night. Teachers dealing with their own demons that were suppressed. A teacher who had been sexually abused by a priest has chosen to become a teacher and work with victims of sexual abuse. And so all of these stories written by these 150 teachers really give a window into our world and an expose of what teachers deal with, because it's so much broader when you're a teacher. You're a teacher, a cheerleader, a counselor. And for a lot of these teachers, they become a surrogate parent.
Well, and you have to figure out the law many times. A teacher writes about a student who comes to school and gets into a scuffle with the teacher. And the teacher doesn't want to give a statement against the student, but she's told that the student will at least get some counseling if charges are pressed.
In that particular story, it's great. And I just saw that teacher. She was teaching in St. Louis. The student actually hit her in the middle of a class. And so the student was arrested, and she was given counseling to go to court, and that if she went to court, this young woman would actually get some kind of counseling. And they did a switcheroony in the middle of court. The young woman pleaded guilty, and everything happened so fast, and she wasn't going to get counseling, and she was going to be kicked out of school. And so I think a lot of teachers will come to this book and find out things that they may not find out in the halls of academia.
Well, by the way, Sifa Kaur Ama of Fort Worth, Texas, writes in your new book about a time she pulled a young woman away from a confrontation in the cafeteria. And here's the exchange she writes about. She says, "Butler Housing Projects, huh? Is that where you're from?" I ask. The student nods. I continue. "So that makes you a gangster? Girl, you're just a wangster. I'm from Cabrini Green Projects in Chicago. I'm a real gangster." Again, that's the teacher speaking. The student ends up laughing, then crying, then confessing she doesn't want to fight, but she doesn't know how not to fight. But you know, some might wonder, well, gee, how much should a teacher be trying to one-up students, and how much should teachers cross that line?
That's a great question. I think in this particular case and in this story, Sifa Kaur is a gentle giant, and she did grow up in Cabrini Greens, one of the most notorious housing projects in America. And she could live in suburbia, and she made a choice to live in the community that she teaches, which is a community that's underserved, and most of her kids come from housing projects. And I don't think she was trying to one-up her students in this particular case. I think she was trying to show them that there are other ways to make it. You don't have to hit a ball over a fence or slam dunk a ball into a basket or get up on MTV and rap to America as your ticket out of town. And that's oftentimes what happens in some of these very difficult economic areas. Kids look at the local drug dealer and think, that's an easy way to make a buck. And I think what Sifa Kaur was trying to say is, I made it, and I made it through education. And in doing so, I didn't desert who I was or where I came from. And I think she's trying to illuminate, this is who I am, and this is where I'm from, and I'm not running away from my roots.
That's teacher and author Erin Gruwell. With her students, she produced the best-selling book, The Freedom Writer's Diary. In her new book, teachers tell their stories. When we come back, how her former students are now helping teachers tell their stories through a foundation that Erin has set up. Also, later today, more questions about tracking troubled U.S. troops when they come home. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with teacher Erin Gruwell. In her first book, The Freedom Writer's Diary, her inner city students told their stories. Her new book, Teaching Hope, is from the perspective of teachers that she and her former students trained at their Freedom Writers Foundation. Well, Kathy Cappy Cantu is one of those teachers. Kathy, you wrote about the reaction you received from parents in Howell, Michigan, when you assigned Erin's first book in your high school English class. What happened?
The parents came and asked that we not teach the book because they felt it was pornographic. They felt that the language was inappropriate and that no student should read it.
Well, now we should say yours was a pretty exclusively white town. The kids in the book were inner city, of color, of poverty, writing about drugs, violence, being molested, and the parents objected to that?
Absolutely. And it wasn't that, I think what really sparked the controversy that happened is it wasn't one parent who said, I don't want my son or daughter to read this book because I feel like it's not the right time for him or her to read it, which would have been absolutely wonderfully, you have every right to make that decision for your child. Instead, this parent said, I don't think my son should read it, and I don't think anybody else should read it, and therefore I'm going above your head.
Well, then they did, and the book was temporarily banned, then brought back. The school says they had to review the book. But, Kathy, I'm wondering if it raises a question that we already know that middle-class kids romanticize the gangsta culture. We talked about that, just a little bit. And while this book might be therapy for one set of kids, it might be titillating.
I disagree, because yeah. I think if you look at the word titillating, you're asking for a specific reaction from kids or from the reader. By calling something titillating, as was the word used by some people calling the book pornographic, is that you're saying you want them to be aroused in some way. And that's not the point of the book. That's not how I was teaching the book. That's not what the Freedom Writers intended by telling their story of what they went through. I don't think you can call someone's abuse titillating in any way.
Well, Erin Gruel, Kathy says she feels racism was the reason the parents didn't want the book taught. What was your reaction when you found out it was being banned?
What we found, Robin, is the greatest way to get a group of teenagers to read a book is essentially to have controversy and to try and ban it. And we were so lucky to actually meet Kathy and her students at a town hall in Michigan. And the stories that we heard from the students were flabbergasting. They would see swastikas carved in lockers. Hearing the N-word in the hallway was normal. And when we were together with the students and talking about this book, many of the students talked about what it felt like to see crosses being burned at their local cemetery on a Saturday evening, to see those white robes hanging in their grandparents' closets. And it really created this great dialogue about race and about sensationalism. And because the Freedom Writers wrote their truth, what they wanted is that people would pick up the book and find their own story, pick up a pen, pick up a journal, and tell their own story. And I think that's exactly what Kathy was able to do with her students, is to tell them to go back and rewrite that ending. You can't change the cast of characters you were given, but you don't have to be like your parents. You don't have to allow those words into your vocabulary. You don't have to wear those white robes on a Saturday evening. And I think something beautiful happened in that community, because when the book was removed from the school, it was the students who rallied behind the Freedom Writers' Diary, and it was the students who took it upon themselves to contact local universities and bookstores, and were truly the reason that the Freedom Writers and I went to Michigan, met Kathy, and invited her to come and be a part of the Freedom Writer teacher program.
Well, I'm thinking, too, that not every high schooler's problem has to do with inner-city drugs. There are kids in very upscale gated communities who might have alcoholism in their family or might have some of these issues that they have no way to talk about.
Everyone has a story, whether it's an eating disorder, parents getting a divorce, trying to find your way and your identity in a culture that oftentimes denounces you. And I think whether it's a kid grappling with taking Ritalin because they have ADHD, or a kid trying to figure out what their parents are going to do if they're going to get divorced or stay together. And so many of those stories have nothing to do with economics, but the realities of being a teenager.
Kathy, Erin mentioned that you came to the foundation as one of her scholarship teachers. What did you learn?
I really learned that it doesn't matter what classroom I teach in, what my students are like. All kids crave to tell their story. And I think that because, especially with where I taught in Howell, and then with contrasting to where I'm teaching currently, because I did enter the Institute in between teaching in Howell and where I'm teaching now in Muskegon, that ultimately our kids are kids. And I need to listen to what the kids have to say. I need to figure out how the kids are going to best learn. And while I'm doing some of that already, it opened my eyes to new ways of finding this information, of new ways of bringing not only the actual curriculum to the students, but them learning how to use the curriculum in their way based on who they are.
Well, Erin, your book reads like a year in the life of a teacher, starting with frustrations teachers face.
And it ends with a story written by a woman who teaches at a boot camp in Wyoming. And she calls her young men and women who've come from juvenile halls and continuation schools, are now in this boot camp program. She calls them her wingless angels. And through her program and our curriculum, she teaches them what to do with those wings and how to fly. And in the bookends of that book, those 150 stories really go through the year in the life of a teacher, the anticipation, the challenges they face, desperately trying to engage their students, and then those moments where teachers are disillusioned and they quit and then they unquit and they realize this is a calling, this is the profession I want, and then trying to build those bridges with their students. And then most importantly, the book ends with this empowerment, and that's what all of us want in our profession. We have had this profession politicized, and people make a lot of decisions for a profession who've never been in a classroom, and we want to change education, one kid at a time, one classroom at a time.
That's Erin Gruhl. Her new book is Teaching Hope, Stories from the Freedom Rider Teachers. Also joining us, one of those teachers, Kathy Cabby Cantu. She contributed to the book and went through Erin's Freedom Riders Foundation. I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you
so much.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, GM is struggling at home, but business is booming in China. We'll check in with GM's top guy in Shanghai. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman, a fly on the wall of the Paris Opera Ballet. Aren't we lucky? Latest news is next, Here and Now. The fate of a man facing execution in Texas tonight is in the hands of Governor Rick Perry after the state parole board yesterday recommended that Robert Lee Thompson's death sentence be commuted to life in prison. Thompson was not the trigger man in the 1996 killing of a Houston convenience store clerk. He shot a clerk who didn't die and was sentenced to death under the Texas Law of Parties, which allows execution of someone who plays a role in a murder. The shooter in the case, Sammy Butler, was convicted in a separate trial. He was only sentenced to life in prison. Houston Chronicle investigative reporter Lisa Olson joins us. And Lisa, you know, people might wonder, how is that possible? The person who shot the person who died gets life. The accomplice is about to be executed.
It's because two separate trials took place, and the verdicts were handled by two separate juries.
Right.
So the decisions weren't made together, and that's the argument now that the attorney for Mr. Thompson is making, that this is clearly unfair and should be reviewed.
Do we know why the Board of Pardons and Parole agrees with Thompson's lawyer and recommends that Thompson's life be spared?
No, we don't. All we know is that they took a vote to commute the sentence. They typically don't meet publicly to discuss these death penalty cases, and they don't reveal information about their deliberations. They simply release information about whether they voted up or down. It's very rare for them to vote for commutation of sentence.
Well, but we do know that there was another case involving a man named Kenneth Foster, who was the driver in a series of robberies in San Antonio. A man was killed by Foster's accomplice, but both men in that case were sentenced to death, and Governor Perry did commute Foster's case, again, the driver's case, the accomplice's death sentence in that case. So he has at least a precedent for that.
That's right. That's another so-called law of parties case where an accomplice was sentenced to death. The difference is that Foster and the gunman in that case were tried in the same trial, and Governor Perry has said that he felt that that was unfair, and that's why he commuted that sentence.
Yeah.
He has made it clear that he does not necessarily feel the same way about all law of party cases. However, he has not said anything yet about what he's going to do in the Thompson case. We assume there'll be some sort of decision today since the execution is scheduled for tonight.
Right. And again, Foster drove the car, the getaway car. He had a commutation. But the man we're talking about, who's scheduled to be executed tonight, Robert Lee Thompson, he also did fire a gun in that robbery attempt, and the clerk he shot did not die. So there's another difference between the two men. But we spoke to you recently about questions about Governor Rick Perry's handling of death penalty cases, one in particular that involved a last-minute report to the governor that cast doubt on yet another man's guilt. This was an arson case, and there were questions about whether Governor Perry even read that report at the last minute. Do we know how he's handling today's request for commutation?
No, we don't. One of the issues has been that Governor Perry has said that his reviews are not public, that we do know in general that he assigns a staff member, an attorney, to review each execution, scheduled execution, and brief him. What he's refused to reveal is the content of those briefings or any deliberations by him or his staff on execution. Yeah. So we know the process, but we don't know what specifically is being discussed.
And Lisa, put us, we've got about a minute left. Just put a little context here. There's some political ramifications. What else is going on in Texas?
Well, we've had some debate based on that arson case about clemency reviews in Texas. Governor Perry has presided over 200 executions during his nearly 9 years in office, and that certainly is something that's being discussed. We have had fewer people being sentenced to death since we had a change in law where life without parole is now an option in Texas, but we still have a lot of executions, and whether or not those are reviewed is now the kind of the question.
Well, some 200 people have been executed while Perry's been governor, and he had one commutation that we spoke of, and he's up for re-election, so a lot going on. Lisa Olson, investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle. They're in Houston. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, the shootings at Fort Carson. Did the Army miss evidence that several soldiers could become violent? This is a separate case from Fort Hood. We'll take a deeper look at it in 30 seconds here and now. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling is reporting today that in 2007, a top psychiatrist at Walter Reed Hospital wrote a memo about psychiatrist Nidal Hassan's incompetence and sent that memo to Fort Hood when Major Hassan was transferred there. But the Army still assigned Hassan to some of the most vulnerable troops. Well, the memo is written confirmation of anecdotes that Daniel had heard, and it comes as a Senate committee today looks into possible missed signals about Hassan's incompetence and his radicalized Muslim faith. But if the military looked only for radicalized Muslims, they would have missed the shooters in another spree at Fort Carson in Colorado. In that case, combat troops, some diagnosed with PTSD, produced the largest killing spree involving soldiers at a single U.S. military base in modern history. 14 troops have been charged or convicted in 11 slayings since 2005, a record eclipsed only by the Fort Hood shootings. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling did early reports on Fort Carson, and now L. Christopher Smith, or Lee Smith, explores them for Rolling Stone magazine. He tracks three soldiers, Louis Bressler, Bruce Bastian, and Kenneth Eastridge. They saw people die horribly in Iraq. All three left early. Two were diagnosed with PTSD. All three are now in prison for a variety of crimes on the base, including Lee, a stabbing and several shootings.
The most terrifying of the incidents that they were involved in was the shooting of an individual that they picked up. According to police, Louis Bressler shot him execution style in the head.
Okay. In your story, what they saw in Iraq is horrific. What they did when they came home is horrific. But we want to concentrate on what the Army didn't do. As you write, there was a huge report that was released in July, the first time the military acknowledged the significance of combat in the behavior of returning veterans. But it seems to go even beyond that. For instance, you've got Ken Eastridge, one of the troops in the killing spree. At the age of 12, he shot and killed his best friend while playing a video game. Now, as you write, that juvenile record should have kept him from ever going in the military, but he did.
That's correct. And Kenneth Eastridge signed up for the Army at a time when the Army was hard-pressed for able-bodied soldiers. And he was given a waiver to enlist. And Kenneth Eastridge admitted in a Colorado Springs Gazette article that he may have committed war crimes, randomly shooting civilians in Iraq. He also came back from his first tour with obvious signs of PTSD, and he was given what's called a post-deployment assessment, which is basically a quick rundown of questions. Are you anxious, hypervigilant? He actually answered a number of those questions in a positive, meaning that by Army policy, it required a follow-up, but no follow-up was ever made.
Lack of follow-up seems to be the headline. Louis Bressler, who unravels after a friend is killed, does go to the hospital at Fort Carson, but the hospital is completely understaffed, and soldiers talked about a cookie-cutter treatment. Everyone just getting Zoloft?
Yes, I was actually able to speak with a mental health care provider who was working at Fort Carson's Evans Hospital at that time. What he said was that the staff was understaffed by about 35%. They could only meet with soldiers for 20-minute briefs, and soldiers felt they weren't being heard. They regularly didn't return back for treatment. And the mental health care provider that I spoke with, Justin Cole, who was at the time the chief of social work, He told me that it wasn't uncommon to be seeing a soldier on a Friday who clearly needed some serious help. Sending him on his way was Zoloft, and then getting a call on a Monday from the morgue saying that somebody down here needs to identify this body. And that body was of the soldier they had seen on Friday. He had committed suicide over the weekend.
Well, then you have Louis Ressler, who threatens to kill his wife with a gun, but then attempts a suicide himself. He does end up in a locked psychiatric ward. But his pal, Bruce Bastian, is able to walk in and get him released?
That's a enormous failure across the board, to get a soldier out of a locked psychiatric ward. His chain of command has to be notified, and Bruce Bastian, who was only a medic, a private, in fact, was able to present himself to the nurse at the hospital as a sergeant command.
He claimed to be Bressler's sergeant.
And was able to sign him out.
Yeah. You did all of this research and wrote this story before the Fort Hood shooting and the stories that came out about the warning signs about Major Hassan that were missed at Walter Reed Hospital. Mm-hmm. What did you think when you heard that?
Some of the things that we saw in the papers seemed to conform with what soldiers and mental health care providers and that I spoke with members of the Pentagon were telling me, and that is that you see these mental health care providers who had never necessarily been in combat, who've been treating soldiers now for 7 years, and they develop a phenomenon that's known now as secondary PTSD. And Justin Cole, the social work chief that I spoke with, told me that two good friends actually have committed suicide in the last year. And these were people who he believed were suffering from secondary PTSD.
Well, and even if people don't buy that, and as you know, a lot of people don't,
yes,
with Major Hassan, what seemed to be an analogy is that there was an attitude of, if there's a problem, the best thing to do with it is to just push it down the road.
That's been the Army's MO for quite a while. I read one report that Major Hassan had turned down a suggested visit with an Army psychiatrist. That shouldn't be an optional choice. That really should be mandatory.
And you also cite a memo we've seen cited before from the chief of mental health at Evans Hospital there in Colorado, who said the thinking was, get rid of dead wood.
Exactly. The soldiers who were shown to be suffering from PTSD, it was encouraged at Evans and Army-wide that these are soldiers who are going to be a lag against a unit. They usually do not recover in a way that allows them to return to combat. The unit is not able to get replacement soldiers while a soldier is getting treated for PTSD. So it's a lose-lose from the leadership point of view. So the best thing to do is to chapter these individuals out of the Army, send them on to the Veterans Administration, and let them take care of them.
Well, but you spoke to the commander at Fort Carson in August as he was stepping down, and he says, even if you could identify high-risk soldiers, what are you going to do? Lock them up? What you have to do is watch their behavior. Is there really an answer to what needs to happen?
Major General Graham himself gave the answer, and that is you have to watch their behavior. And the only way to watch the behavior of soldiers is to have the resources where hospitals are not understaffed. You can't lose track of soldiers in the system. Fort Carson, for instance, was notorious for sending a lot of its soldiers that were suffering from mental health problems to area hospitals. They outsourced at a rate about 700 times greater than the Army average. And inevitably, when that happens, you're going to lose track of soldiers. Civilian health care providers complained to Fort Carson and said, you're giving us all of these patients that we don't have room for. And eventually there was some discussion between Fort Carson and the local civilian hospitals to come up with a better plan for tracking these soldiers. But you're still seeing a lot of soldiers getting lost in the system when you send them to civilian hospitals. It's inevitable.
L. Christopher Smith writes about the shootings in Fort Carson, Colorado from 2005 on in Rolling Stone magazine. Lee, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, Robin.
The New York Times calls Frederick Wiseman's latest documentary, La Danse, one of the best dance films ever made, and it is so beautiful. But it provoked a lot of questions for us. Why do we see performances by the famed Paris Opera Ballet but never hear applause? And why is there no narrator? Well, on that, you might as well ask why? Because whether he's documenting a mental institution in Titicut Follies or the Idaho legislature in State Legislature, Frederick Wiseman lets his resulting footage tell the story. He's a master of cinema verite. For La Danse, which opens in Chicago and California tomorrow, his subject is the Paris Opera Ballet, whose roots reach back to Louis XIV in the 1600s. It is the rare moment in the film that this company is anything but distinctly French.
And very soft legs.
Soft feet. Soft and one.
A rare bit of English heard as dancers take their daily ballet class in La Danse, and filmmaker Frederick Wiseman joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. I'm glad to be here again.
Well, yeah, we're glad to have you. And to the question some others might have, why the Paris Ballet? I'm wondering, you're a fan and studied law in Paris. Is that when you discovered the ballet?
Actually, not. I don't think I had the money to go to the ballet when I was a student there. I used to sneak into the ballet in New York when I was in law school. I never, you know, I didn't know anything technically about a ballet when I started going. I suppose it interested me. I'd read about it. And I became fascinated with this beautiful form, which is so evanescent, so ephemeral, and all the work that goes into it, and it's over in a flash. And I think some of the ballets I've watched are among the most beautiful things I've ever seen. So I've always, for a long time, been a fan. And I did another ballet movie in 1992 about the American Ballet Theater. And the last 7 or 8 years, I've been living in Paris at least half the year with one project or another. Mainly, I wanted to do the movie because I like ballet and
right.
It was fun and I could stay in Paris.
Right. And it seems to be as much a film about ballet as it is about excellence and mastery and maybe obsession?
And discipline. I think all those words apply because the dances, many of the dances start when they're 6, 7 years old. They have to retire when they're 40, but for many of them, their careers are over before that. And it requires enormous sacrifice, dedication, and discipline. But curiously enough, once they become masters at it, there's an enormous amount of freedom in the discipline because they can do almost anything with their bodies.
Well, but before that, we watch scene after scene, dancers being coached by former Paris Opera Ballet stars. The level of corrections and adjustments, a tiny pinky, I mean, to the untrained eye, I can't see what everyone's, oh, oui, yes, we must do this different. And I can't see it because it's so nuanced. Did it ever seem a little obsessive to you? Or?
Well, no, it didn't seem obsessive to me. It seemed to me that, what's the cliche, the devil's in the details. And in those rehearsals, you were watching former stars of the company and choreographers explain exactly what they wanted. And the Paris Opera Ballet has existed for 300 years. It has a long tradition. It gets a subsidy from the state. One of the reasons they've existed so long is because they do get that subsidy.
Well, and we're guessing that maybe that's why they can spend so much time with the coaching and the rehearsing, and
right.
They can be so in-depth
right.
Because they're... But there are a couple of scenes where... I mean, it's abusive. I should say just one, where some unseen ballet masters are ripping into the dancers who are at this point on the stage doing a rehearsal.
Right.
And, you know, they're not getting their lines straight. They're not getting their legs high enough. Let's listen.
Mais il faut qu'il soit complètement haut de la diagonale, Julien.
Vous êtes trop serré, il n'y a pas la place, là.
Voilà, voilà, là, il est bien placé.
Pour commencer.
Ben oui, l'autre doit
faire
les bras en ordi.
C'est mou, Julien.
Well, yeah, the legs aren't high enough and they haven't formed the right diagonal. But, you know, there's a standard. There's a way it's supposed to be done. And there's a general interest in avoiding sloppiness or neglect of the work.
One other thing we noticed, very wide shots. It's not cut up, like a montage. We see a dance. But it had an interesting effect, at least for me, the viewer, because we never really hear from the dancers. The dancers are interacting with their coaches or performing. We never really hear from them, and it makes them feel even more to me like these vessels into which choreographers and masters pour this idea of how to perform.
Well, I think that's true, but it's not the whole story because... They're selected because of their enormous skill, but they are asked to do what they're told.
Yeah.
And the quality comes out of a combination of the union, of the fusion of those two things.
And in that way, it's unbelievably collaborative.
It's very collaborative.
Yeah.
And also, the ballet masters and the choreographers were always open to comments the dancers had about what worked and what didn't work or what felt right or what was needed.
Frederick Wiseman talking about his new film, La Danse. How much time did you spend with the Paris Opera Ballet?
12 weeks shooting it, then it took me about a year to edit it.
Yeah. Was it tough to be let in to no. these sacred
I mean,
halls?
I was very, I simply called up Brigitte Lefebvre, the administrator of the dance company, and asked her if I could come see her. Mm. I saw her, and she said okay, and she gave me permission right away, and there was nothing that I couldn't shoot.
Well, and in the film, we see your well-known static shots. They almost look like photographs of the circular stairs at the Paris Opera. Think Phantom of the Opera. But we also see the fish and plants that flourish in the underground grottos beneath the building, and the very quiet woman who sews the rat head costumes for the Nutcracker and spray paints the slippers with a machine, just people quietly going about their work. What were some of your images that stayed with you, that you unexpected finds, you know, as you roamed around this building?
Well, much of it is unexpected. Some of it's just a matter of luck. You stumble across something that's interesting, like the beekeeper on top of the opera.
Well, wait. We got to stop there for a second. Yes, suddenly you're on the roof. What was he doing there?
Tending his bees. He's a former technician, stagehand, and... When he retired, he kept bees in the country, and he asked whether he could keep them in the city. And they said yes, and they sell the honey of the Paris Opera Ballet at the store there.
And you couldn't help but think, all those bees, when you showed us the bees on the slats that got pulled out, that's what sometimes the dancers look like, you know, busy bees. Well, you're not making any connection. How much fun do you have when you put a beekeeper in the middle of your
piece? A lot. Making that movie was a pleasure. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah. Why no applause? We see so many performances ultimately. We move from classes to rehearsals to performances. And the sound fades just as one would think that the...
Well, because I don't think there's any need... I didn't think there was any need to show that the audience appreciated the work of these great dancers. You have to make up your own mind.
Frederick Wiseman, who gives us insights into the Paris Opera Ballet in his new film, La Danse, and also, as always, insights into why you make the choices you make as an independent filmmaker. What's next, by the way?
I'm just finishing a movie about a boxing gym, which is not unrelated to dance. The result is a bit more violent, but it's another film about people who have to control all aspects of their body for their work.
In fact, Madame Lefebvre, the director of the Paris Opera Ballet, at one point quotes, I can't remember who famous dancer is, saying that ballet dancers are half nun, half boxer.
Right, half nun, half boxer, a half racing car driver, half racing car.
Frederick Wiseman, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.